You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Ted Pacone, and I'm the acting director of the foreign policy program here at the Brookings Institution. Thanks for coming out on this sweltering day to hear some words about, I think, a pretty hot topic, even though it may not be all that sexy to some people. I think UN peacekeeping actually is one of the remarkable success stories of the international order over the last several decades. And we have with us today to hear more about it the Undersecretary General of the United Nations for Peacekeeping Operations, Hervé Latsouze. UN peacekeeping is facing dramatic new challenges. You're seeing increasing demands from the UN Security Council for their involvement in a number of very complex cases. Support from the traditional troop-contributing countries is under stress. I'm thinking of India, Pakistan, Nigeria, and others that are feeling the effects of their many, many years of contributions and the costs associated with those. And then you have traditional donors who are increasingly balking at the price tag involved in these kinds of operations, even though when you compare it to the cost of, say, U.S. Military operation, it's really a fraction of the cost. We're talking now around $8 billion a year in the annual peacekeeping budget. If anyone is following this issue closely, you'll know that this is a major topic of discussion and debate right now on Capitol Hill as the appropriations bills wind their way through Congress and a number of markups that dramatically cut the U.S. contribution to UN peacekeeping operations. These operations are enmeshed in intractable conflicts in places like Sudan and the Democratic Republic of the Congo and Somalia. And these mandates have expanded over time in terms of their role to include protection of civilians, which, as important and laudable as that goal is, raises a whole set of complicated doctrinal questions and how to put that into effect. Just to remind you, we're now talking about 98,000 personnel from over 120 countries from around the world, 17 missions, mostly in Africa. So it gives you a sense of the scope of activity we're going to be talking about this afternoon. Let me say a word. You have our bios in front of you, but let me just mention that Hervé Latsouze has a longstanding, impressive career in the French Foreign Service, a number of positions, including in Haiti as the Deputy Permanent Representative to the UN in New York. He was the French ambassador in Vienna at the OSCE and France's ambassador to both Indonesia and then later to Beijing. He also served as the Chief of Staff for the French Minister of Foreign and European Affairs. The Undersecretary General will make some remarks from the podium, and then our Senior Fellow and Director of Research, Michael Hanlon, will join him here for a discussion and time for question and answers. So thank you for coming, and please welcome Hervé Latsouze to the podium.
Thank you, Mr. Pecon, for your kind words, and ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. I would like to first thank the Brookings Institution for giving me this opportunity to share with you some of our thoughts and some of our views and discuss them maybe later. Let me say by stating the obvious that United Nations peacekeeping is a collective effort. And as the world changes around us, it is essential that the diverse stakeholders who authorize, who finance, who contribute personnel to peacekeeping operations reflect collectively on the role of peacekeeping in that global changing landscape. The Secretary General has called for a major review as recently as last week, a major review of United Nations peacekeeping And we are currently embarking on this very important, very necessary, and very timely process. And I would like today to highlight to you some of the issues which I feel need to be at the center of the exercise, based on my almost 3 years now experience as the head of that Department of the United Nations. Over recent decades, the number and the level of conflict in the world has declined. And I think, despite very visible, very spiky situations, we can still say that today they remain at a historically low level globally. And indeed, United Nations peacekeeping operations have played a role in helping to resolve several of these conflicts after the period of the Cold War, often by monitoring and supporting implementation of peace agreements. Remember El Salvador, Mozambique, Namibia, and that counts. Of course, there are no guarantees, and peacekeeping remains a high-risk endeavor. But I think many people agree that a country probably has a better chance of emerging from conflict and maintaining the peace once a peace operation has been deployed. Timor-Leste, Sierra Leone, Liberia, Cambodia, just a few of those countries which are now, have been now for some years on the path to peace, in good measure thanks to the peacekeepers of the United Nations. Yet the conflicts that are in front of us today, fewer in number, but they are some of the most intractable. Democratic Republic of Congo, South Sudan, some of them are already confronting, you know, a second or sometimes a third wave of conflict. And these conflicts, which are essentially intrastate, become increasingly regionalized, not to say internationalized, certainly more prolonged, more deadly. And the net result is that 9 out of 10 peacekeepers today are serving in Africa throughout that arc of crisis that stretches across the continent from the Atlantic Ocean to the Indian Ocean and in some respects beyond. They are driven by a very complex mixture of factors, failing or incapable states, ethnic strife, transnational crime, terrorist threats, and unfortunately, even worse, serious humanitarian and public health crisis. So fewer but more complex, more entrenched conflicts. And in all these situations, the Security Council has continued to turn to peacekeeping. Today, if I may, Mr. Picon, the actual number of our people on the ground across the 17 missions, military, police, civilian, amounts to almost 120,000 people altogether. And this will yet further increase in coming months because of the new mandate we have been given in Central African Republic and the surge we are facing in South Sudan. So we have more than ever to strive to provide a dynamic response in some of those most difficult and complicated places on the earth. And increasingly, we are asked to intervene earlier when there may be an opening in the midst of ongoing conflict so as to buttress a fragile peace to protect civilians. And, of course, we have had in all these contexts to adapt and to respond. A few examples. North Darfur, where we are serving in an increasingly hostile environment, 400,000 more displaced persons this year, where, let's face it, there is little peace to keep. So what do we do to keep women and children caught between those warfaring groups to yet retain a better chance for a better life? South Sudan, where, you know, the cycle of violence has erupted violently 6 months ago, where we are taking care of 90,000 IDPs in our camps and trying to help towards securing a peaceful process. I think we were shown in that particular case to be able to respond quickly, but it is classically a case of overstretch for us and immense challenge. In Mali, where we face asymmetric threats, a few days ago, another 4 Chadian peacekeepers were killed by an IED explosion, and that happens, unfortunately, regularly. Too many dangers lurking just around the corner, and, of course, again, a peaceful political process that needs to be pushed. In the Democratic Congo, I think we are going after armed groups in the hills of the North Kivu with added determination, added vigor. I'm pleased to say last year, added success, which had not been the case in previous years. And of course, we are helped in protecting the most vulnerable who suffered so much over two decades in terms of people killed, displaced, women raped, children absconded and recruited forcefully. Now we are using also the latest technology with surveillance UAVs to actually do a better job, and it does make a tremendous difference. So this illustrates the fact that we continue to seek creative solutions. But clearly, to continue strengthening UN peacekeeping further, I think we have to continue on a more systemic and always collective effort. Last week, 60 member states of the UN came together in the Security Council to discuss the current trends of UN peacekeeping. That was an initiative of the Russian presidency for the month. And this was an opportunity for the Secretary General, as he launched the concept of this review I mentioned earlier, to draw out some of the implications of the trends that we have noticed recently for what we are today and what we should become later. First, it is clear that we are operating in a very dangerous environment. More than two-thirds of our personnel all over are operating in contexts with very significant levels of ongoing violence, mostly in Africa. This, of course, impacts our ability both to start up new missions and, once we are deployed, to operate effectively and safely. So we need, and as I will discuss, we need to modernize our capabilities to ensure that we can indeed achieve our tasks while taking care of our personnel, ensuring their safety and security. And this, of course, is somewhere where the member states can help us with capabilities to step ahead. Second, several of our peacekeeping operations are mandated to advance national reconciliation, national dialogue, in the absence, let's face it, of a peace agreement, and sometimes in the absence of even clear indication of the parties to the conflict. Clearly, the Security Council sometimes wishes us not to stand by while civilians are killed in the middle of conflict. That is the case in Darfur. In some cases, the Council decided to deploy a peacekeeping operation because they want to either create some space or buttress an opening, however incomplete. And the idea is to use the peacekeeping operation as a wedge to build some momentum. And this is why we are mandated to try and do in Central African Republic and in Mali. In South Sudan, it is mainly about protection of the civilians against absolutely shocking violence, but at the same time, never forgetting that what is really necessary at the end of the day is a political solution. The third element contemporarily is that we work in partnership with others to address all these transnational threats like organized crime, terrorism, IEDs, rockets, kidnapping, and let's not forget also drug trafficking. So we need to build our capabilities to operate effectively and more safely in those very difficult environments. We need specialized expertise. Precisely in Mali, we are just about, I will open next month, a novelty in our system, a specialized cell dedicated to counter-narcotics and transnational organized crime to assist the Malian police and other agencies in addressing all those networks who have been one of the drivers of the conflict in northern Mali. These transnational actors also present political challenges. Often they have little stake in the countries where they operate, and they can hardly, if at all, be brought into a political process. Let's face it, Security Council does not have either much leverage on some of those people. That compares, of course, to other armed groups that depend upon external support and which can access and impact through sanctions, through a number of tools. Fourth element is that in the face of these challenges, the Council has begun to approve, in some cases, robust, even very robust mandates. The creation, the authorization last year of a force intervention brigade in the DRC with a mandate to, and I quote, neutralize the armed groups, prevent their growth, neutralize and disarm them, that is the exact quote. I think this is really a very significant factor. There have been very robust capabilities in the past. UNPROFOR in Bosnia-Herzegovina in the mid-90s was one. And it's not so different. But I think it illustrates that there are cycles, maybe, and that at various stages we are asked to respond very forcefully to very significant threats to civilians and to constitutional order. So now, looking forward, what does this all mean? First, we see that some of the biggest challenges we face are essentially political. Many of those environments to which we deploy do not have a clear political framework to guide either the government or the other parties towards an inclusive political order post-conflict that should not be violent. Without an agreed roadmap, the central political role of a mission can be challenged by all parties, but it can be challenged, including by the government. And it is a matter of striking the proper balance between the two principles of the consent of the host government and the impartiality of the UN, and that can be a challenge, as we have experienced recently in South Sudan or in Mali. In the contrast, in the DRC, the fact that we have now a regional political framework bringing in the countries of the region, I think, is a better guarantee that we will continue to make progress. So it is essential that in all these situations we assist the parties to put together a basic roadmap for peace. We bring in there our good officers' role, our impartiality. We must insist on political inclusivity. And, of course, establish a degree of the legitimacy for the interim political structure. We must build confidence among the population. And where there are political openings, we must be prepared with the required plans, the required expertise, to assist in strengthening the rule of law, the disarmament and demobilization processes, the security sector reform, democratic processes, not to mention mine action, core government functions to restart. So it's a very wide, we call them multidisciplinary missions, and all these pieces to a degree are essential in the picture. But clearly the Security Council makes it repeatedly clear that the protection of civilians is at the center, the core of our responsibilities. And this is acknowledged by contributors of troops and police. But to do it, actually, it demands a willingness to be proactive, a decisive attitude in those very high-risk environments. And I am proud, I have to say, about our response during the recent crisis in South Sudan. I said it, we opened our bases. I think that saved tens of thousands of lives. It is, of course, not sufficient because a lot of atrocities are happening in other places. So as we are bringing in more troops to South Sudan, we will be able to project more proactively and go and actually act on those situations outside the cities where or places where we have been. It's a matter, you know, a new ethos where we have to be really proactive, as I said, and in a position to respond decisively to the threats as they emerge at various levels. Now, achieving this demands the ability to respond quickly when we are unable to cover large geographic areas. Mobility, agility means that we have to go for new types of capabilities, new equipment, new technology. We need constantly critical force multipliers, enabling capacities, and the example that comes to mind immediately is helicopters. We lack right now 20 helicopters and we'll need more as we develop our presence in Central African Republic, and we turn everywhere, but it's not an easy resource to get by. But it's also not only about equipment, it's also about the mindset. the mindset among those member states who participate in peacekeeping. For this proactive protection to work, the member states must be of the same mind on the support to the activities. They must be of the same mind on the financial regime. They must be of the same mind on the need, the importance of adopting a robust posture in executing those tasks. We have made progress, I think, in developing guidance, training materials, operational concepts, but every time that the lives of civilians are at risk, it is our legitimacy that is at risk, and our performance in the area continues to be a measure of our success. In line with the principle of the Charter, human dignity, sovereignty, human rights, you have seen that the Secretary General adopted recently what we call the Rights Up Front agenda. I think it highlights how critical it is that under our watch, we cannot accept that massive violations of human rights actually are taking place. And we must always respond humanely to individual suffering, disenfranchisement, and marginalization. More materially, we are also working in implementing reforms to the reimbursement regime for the troop costs for peacekeeping. We want something that be more equitable, more predictable, and we're working also on the equipment. These, I think, are opportunities to improve on the system for deploying and compensating people and capabilities that can make a real difference to peacekeeping as we know it. All those who are involved must come to the conclusion that the system is transparent, that it is cost-effective. And we, on the Secretariat side, have to be responsive and pragmatic. At the same time, we need to recognize that there are limits to the capability for protection. And let me say again, it is the search for political solutions. It is a support to the extension of the state authority that will provide eventually more protection, which is the responsibility first and foremost of the government. And of course, when you look at the Central African Republic, where all institutions have failed, basically, it's a matter of picking up what remains of the pieces and trying to bring back a degree of state authority where so far there is none anymore, if there has ever been over the decades. Every peacekeeping operation is unique. It is built upon sometimes slightly different coalitions of engaged member states, but it is above all essential to reinforce the process of peacekeeping. We need a solid Security Council standing as a group behind the operations it has authorized, not only the respective priorities of these or those member states. Without that, we lose a lot in terms of effectiveness. We need to reinforce the system and the standards that shape our activities so that the types of innovation we have worked to pilot in recent years can now become standard practice. After all, we have to take the conflicts of today with the tools of today, not those of a century ago. And we must continue to demonstrate in the context of financial rigor all over the world that we demonstrate strong and effective stewardship of the resources that are entrusted to us. We enhance efficiencies, we innovate. We just created a few weeks ago a high-level panel on technology and innovation that will make propositions so that we can really benefit fully from all these modern technologies, be more effective, be more efficient, including, by the way, more environment-friendly. I have worked to put in place a process of periodic reviews of all missions so that we very regularly, at least once every 2 years, evaluate the conditions on the ground to ensure that the resources are allocated most effectively, that our staffing is adequate, is aligned to the mandates. So let me finish by enumerating six critical priorities that we need to strengthen peacekeeping. First, we have to expand the base of major contributors while deepening the engagement of current contributors. Mr. Picon said we had 120 contributors right now, but we are trying to get more because that is, I think, desirable to preserve the universal character of peacekeeping and to draw upon the full array of capabilities across all our partners. Otherwise, we'll have a gap between the capabilities required and those that are provided. In Mali, we see now a return to peacekeeping of several Western countries. In the DRC, we see some SADC countries who stepped forward with very effective, well-equipped, well-trained units. The UN, at the end of the day, is only as capable as the member states that provide us with our people and our police and our equipment. So, while thanking all these countries for their contributions, it is clear that we cannot reach our full potential if those who have the most significant capabilities do not choose to participate. When a broad cross-section of the UN membership puts boots on the ground, it also sends a critical political signal to the parties in conflict of the resolve of the international community and a decision to see peace maintained. Second factor is cooperation with regional actors. Both in peacekeeping and in peacebuilding today, the playing field is getting more crowded with regional actors, parallel missions, who all want to play an active role in crisis response. And the common thread amongst all these is that we are one amongst multiple actors, missions, and envoys. And of course, this calls for an effort to establish coherence and interoperability. And of course, if we can achieve strong collective partnerships, then I think the impact is magnified. So I'm dedicating a large amount of my time to do that exactly with the African Union and its sub-regional organizations, the European Union, the Collective Security Treaty Organization, NATO, and others, because many of them have the potential either to respond rapidly and globally or to provide us with niche capabilities. The thing is to build those strategic partnerships with key stakeholders and translate them into actual results. Sorry. A third priority is achieving more rapid deployment. When a crisis comes up, it's a race against time, and it begins when we endeavor to deploy to stabilize a country before the situation spirals into further cycles of violence, especially when we are mandated to deploy in situations where conflicts are ongoing, in which each day we are not on the ground is another day of violence, another day of destruction, of suffering. This is going to be the case in Central African Republic. We are deploying by the mandate of the Security Council on the 15th of September, and we must be able by then to show that we are making a difference. And that's going to be a major, major challenge. So this is something that is terribly important, that we be able to deploy peacekeepers in a timely manner. Solution is collective. It cuts across force generation, planning for logistics, military planning, local negotiations, strategic airlift, and the global supply chain, of course. We need constantly, let me say again, engineering, air, ground transport, medical support. These are the most essential choke points. We're trying to shorten this as much as possible, but one limitation, let's face it, is the willingness of member states to prepare troops for peacekeeping missions ahead of a resolution and to ensure that they can meet our standards. Today, regional organizations are playing a vital role in doing this bridging, but we need to build more predictable standby arrangements. That, I think, remains the key. Fourth, we must modernize the capabilities of our peacekeepers. For these new environments, we need to ensure appropriate duty of care and enhance the capabilities of our military and police to confront new threats. There are requirements for robust, highly mobile capabilities, the need for reserve capabilities to enable the adjustment of posture that are called for, and in particular in environments where we face asymmetric threats. So we need training, We need detection capabilities, we need equipment, and of course, much better access to information and improved contingency planning. The fifth cluster of issues has to do with performance. We are being held to increasingly high standards in this area, and we will be expected to demonstrate consistent success to all people around the world. Let's face it, even in my time, there have been failures that were disgraceful, that were unacceptable, and we have investigated on all this, and we continue, and we take measures. But I think also the prevention is a good thing, and this is why we have created a few months ago what we call in UN speak the Office for the Peacekeeping Strategic Partnership, OOF, but in fact it is the Inspector General to my mind, because this is really the institution which is now fully operational that will look at identifying gaps, at addressing systemic issues, and the first mission this institution has done to Darfur came up with a whole batch of recommendations that we are implementing and that I'm sure will make a difference. And of course, let me say that we continue also in this idea of addressing failures. We continue to implement the policy of zero tolerance on misconduct, on sexual abuse, and we try to refine all the systems that have been put in place over the 5 years to address them. The sixth is helping to extend state authorities so that countries can build and sustain the peace themselves. It needs integrated planning. It needs appropriate financing arrangements. It needs major reconfigurations. And this, as I said earlier, is what we have to do up to a point in the Central African Republic. We will not rebuild the whole state, but at least the essential functions of the state, police, justice, territorial administration, these are the indications to the people that the state is back or is there at all. And then you can build the rest, but that comes later. We need flexibility and full accountability to adjust to this. We need also coherence between all the international actors, including even the international financial institutions, so that this can happen. Because ultimately, lasting peace in any country requires state institutions that are functioning, that have legitimacy, that can do their duty in protecting their civilian, their citizens, and providing them with basic services. And that, by the way, once it's achieved, is what will allow us to transition and to draw down, because our missions have to go through those cycles. Lastly, the protection of civilians, which is probably our most challenging mandate. We are deployed in vast areas, often without the necessary mobility to look for the people. And clearly, as long as there is no viable peace, we will never be able to protect everyone in a single country. But still, it behoves us to do our utmost to protect civilians. We must analyze the threats, prioritize the resources, and use everything available to protect the most vulnerable. It is risky. It requires the mission, the support of the Security Council, the commitment of our troop contributors, and it requires determined leadership on the ground. And this is not the smallest issue, but we do work a lot on that. Politically, UN peacekeeping, at the end of the day, rests, as I said, on this global partnership between the Security Council, the troop and the police contributing countries, and the membership of the UN, which finances it collectively. So a very diverse set of stakeholders. And in that context, systemic change is a challenge. I have worked to assure member states that through those periodic reviews I mentioned, through difficult choices, we do try our best to allocate resources efficiently and effectively. I have traveled to missions with officials from our troop and police contributing countries to look at the actual demands on the ground and to look at the best ways to respond. And I believe that over the last 3 years, we have demonstrated the value there is in specific innovations. And there are some shifts in viewpoints and accumulated experience of our membership. But the demands on the ground clearly do not heed the pace of multilateral institutions. And sadly, I would simply mention that for the sixth year in a row, last year, over 100 peacekeepers paid the ultimate price while serving in war-torn countries. But the scale of human suffering that we confront remains immense. So are the sacrifices of our people. I think what is called from all of us is a collective response. When the United Nations can speak with one voice, the result will be a strengthened, a renewed instrument for the advancement of international peace and security. And let's face it, at the end of the day, what better recompense, I don't know what the English word, sorry, reward that the smile of children who after years or sometimes decades of suffering are recovering some hope in the future. That is what peacekeeping is about. I thank you very much.
Mr. Undersecretary General, thank you very much for those inspiring remarks and for all that you and the troops working with you and the civilians do around the world. I wanted to begin with a big, broad question, if I could, and then we'll ultimately go through a couple of the cases that you mentioned, perhaps, and then look to the audience for some additional questions. And I think I know the answer to this, but I'd just like to ask you to lay it out for us. You talk on the one hand about how the UN's doing so much, how the missions are so numerous. The losses have been so great, the cost is high, at least by comparison with previous years in the UN system. And yet you also say that the world's conflicts are fewer in number and haven't been all that numerous. How do we understand those two facts together? Is the UN doing too much? Is it deployed in places where it doesn't need to be? Or are you actually making progress? Are you actually now seeing a world that's starting to become a little more peaceful, and you're able to get a little bit more ahead of the game, as you say, deploying earlier, making more of a difference in a more positive way earlier on? Still a lot of conflict, a lot of problems, but maybe we're seeing some positive momentum towards reducing the overall scale of tragedy in the world. How do I put these different facts together? More missions than ever, and yet supposedly fewer conflicts in the world.
Well, thank you for that question, Mr. O'Hanlon. I think it is a reality that overall there are less conflict in the world, but more intractable. Sorry, there are newer ones, and indeed, 2 years ago we were given a mandate for a short while to supervise a ceasefire or a truce in Syria. That never happened, so after a few short months we decided to call it a day. Last year Mali, this year Central Africa, plus the new situation in South Sudan. But let's not forget that at the same time there are crises that have gone past the worst of the cycle and that those processes are now heading in the right direction. Three examples: Liberia, Côte d'Ivoire, Haiti. I think these illustrate the fact that while there is still a degree of work to do in those three countries, nevertheless, much has been achieved compared to Côte d'Ivoire now to 3 years ago. Still need to work about the DDR. We need to have successful presidential elections in October 2015. But I think the situation does not compare. Liberia, one can say that they have not done enough toward establishing their own security institutions. They still rely too much on the UN, but I mean, there is no major threat against the country, certainly no external threat, as there is no external threat against Haiti. So we have to recognize this, you know, and as things go, taking, of course, always the care to be prudent, because we don't want to squander or jeopardize the investment we've been making over years in these missions, but yet tell the government that it's going to be their show now, it's not going to be open-ended, and that they have to assume the responsibilities, and that we'll be handing them those responsibilities over a period of time which has to be put out very clearly. This is what we're doing. I would hope that other missions in the near future, we can also right-size in view of lesser challenges, better results in building the state or the political process, whatever it is in a specific case. But these are living organisms, you know. Compared to the old-styled peacekeeping operations, which have been presiding for sometimes decades over frozen situations, and that we cannot probably afford to pull out, I'm thinking of the Golan Heights or things like that, these multidimensional, multidisciplinary, political missions have to go through a clear cycle, and when we plan them now, we already have a vision of what the exit strategy will have to be.
That's great. So if, help me with that, just to make sure I'm getting a geographic and mental map, because you're painting a nice picture. I want to just make sure I'm pulling it together correctly. If I listen to you today, you're saying things are going, on balance, a little bit better in much of West Africa. Obviously, there are exceptions and other issues. I think historically they're better in southern in southern Africa. You mentioned some successes there. Probably, even though there's a lot of illicit economies and violence of a different sort in Central America, there are fewer civil wars. And in Southeast Asia, that's probably also true, if I'm not mistaken. So am I correct in thinking that most of the world's problems in general and most of your activity that you're most worried about is in sort of the central swath of Africa, around the Sahel and just below, and then in much of the Middle East, and those are the zones that we're most worried about today?
I completely agree. Middle East, of course, is the historical legacy. The first mission created in 1948 for the surveillance of the truce after the first Israeli-Arab conflict, and then what came to be later, Lebanon, the Golan Heights, and you can assimilate Cyprus in a way, although it's very specific. So that's one cluster. But basically now, yes, there were the cycles in Southeast Asia with Cambodia first, then later Timor-Leste. There was a cycle in Central America with that very specific situation in the Caribbean and Haiti. The fact is that most of that now are remnants from the past. The crux of the matter really is Africa across what I described as this very wide arc of crisis ranging from the Atlantic shores of the Sahel region right off to Somalia. And look at it, there's precious little country that is not affected to a degree or another by all these concatenation of issues, you know, failing state or weak state, religious and ethnic division, jihadism and extremism, drug trafficking and transnational crime, not to mention economic underdevelopment, very drastic, humanitarian issues, undernourishment, environment-related, in some cases, crisis, public health issues, you name it, you've got it to a degree in all these big countries, and I should add also economic misbehavior, a number of actors, people who are simply pillaging the natural resources. Look at the diamonds, the gold in the DRC, in the CAR. Resources are also a factor. So you've got it all, and then, of course, it's a specific mix that you face in each situation, and that's why each mission has to address those along its own merits.
So if we could bear down a little more on this arc of crisis that you describe. Obviously, there are many sources of conflict. There are issues where political actors just don't want to make the peace, where there's too much conflict. Other things that you mentioned get in the way. But I want to focus in on the UN, all the things that you'd like to be able to do better, get more support with. In which conflicts, if you could give us a short list of the conflicts where the lack of adequate UN capacity is maybe a big part of the problem today? Because obviously your overall remarks are framing a need for more help, more cooperation with regional organizations, more help from the north, some of the industrialized countries, more help with enablers, helicopters, logistics. Mm-hmm. But I realize that in some countries, those kinds of capabilities would make a big difference. In other countries, the conflict may not be at a point where you could really do much more, even if you had additional capacity. Or at least I want to put that question to you. Could you give me a short list of countries where, you know, if you could wave your wand, another 10 or 20 or 30% or 50% of UN capacity could make a big difference?
First, let me say the issue is not so much one of numbers of the people on the ground. Of course, we could do more in South Sudan with double the number of soldiers, but that would not really address the issue. The issue is, first and foremost, one of level of equipment, enablers, the capacity for mobility. South Sudan, as you know, had 80 kilometers of paved roads at its independence 3 years ago. Now maybe they have doubled the figure, and in the rainy season, it means you cannot move around if you don't have the aircraft, in particular the helicopters, and we miss them sorely. It can be also, and this is going to be a problem in Central African Republic, that those brave African troops that are deployed under what we call MISCA, the African Union, and will become blue helmets in mid-September, these people simply don't have the equipment. I went to a place north of Bangui called Kagabandoro. There, the situation tactically is very simple. 550 Selikas, the rebel group, very slick, uniform, equipment, moving around with ease. And in front of them, 57 young soldiers from Gabon and Cameroon with just two pickup trucks, non-armed, and enough gasoline to patrol 10 kilometers a day. What do you do in a prefecture as large as that one? It's one of the largest of the countries. These issues have to be addressed. And when these people are re-hatted under your blue helmet, their issues will become our issues. So if I had a magic wand, I would wave it and ask countries like the United Nations, like the United States, like others, to please come and help these countries to be able to do the job, to have everything that is necessary for them. It is also about having the adequate tools, and there we are innovating. I mentioned the UAVs that we have in the DRC, but clearly we need UAVs in Mali. We need UAVs in South Sudan. I asked the president of South Sudan when I saw him last winter. He said, no, I don't want you spying over my army. But imagine the difference it would make in a country like South Sudan to be able to know what's happening, who's fighting where, who's pushing groups of civilians onto the, I wouldn't say the roads, they don't have roads, but pushing them out of their villages, you know, and putting them to hardship. We will need that in Central African Republic also. I think we need also, in specific theaters, more intelligence. This is what we're doing in Mali, where clearly in an asymmetric war where we're attacked by small groups of spoilers, getting a much better situational awareness of what's happening on the ground using various sources will be critical. And we're doing just that for the first time on that scale in a peacekeeping operation. So I could go on, but this is a spirit, you see?
No, it's very good. And one last question for me, and then we'll soon go to you folks in the crowd. Could you give an example of a couple of examples of where current missions are actually starting to turn the corner in a positive direction? You mentioned cases, historical successes in your speech. You mentioned a moment ago Liberia and Ivory Coast and Haiti, where things are generally going in a better direction. Are there other cases where you see the momentum at least turning in the right direction? It may be very, very preliminary, but just so we get a full map of the in our heads of the missions that you think are doing pretty well, and maybe those where we're still fundamentally, at loggerheads.
One mission that comes to mind clearly is the MONUSCO in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and I say this with great caution, but I think the year 2013 saw very significant progress. You might remember on the 23rd of November 2012, the fall of Goma to this rebel group called themselves the M23. It was horrible. It was uncalled for. There were good military reasons for that, in particular the fact that M23, by a sort of miracle, got night vision equipment simply overnight, which we did not have. So they were able to overturn our positions attack us from the back, and the fall of Goma was then an unavoidable fact. And then what followed, massive violations, rapes in Minova, 223 women raped, plus all. So that was horrendous. And a year later, we had M23 cornered and surrendering, and at the same time accepting to sign a sort of agreement that was a game changer in the region. Because in the meantime, we had put together a political approach, bringing together the commitments of the government of the DRC to do everything that was needed from their point of view to address the root causes of the conflict, address the DDR, the security sector reform, a number of regional reforms, and commitments by the countries of the region. And the first commitment was to respect the sovereignty of its neighbors. And doing that, you know, meant that there was less support for the armed groups. At the same time, we had been authorized to establish the intervention brigade within MONUSCO with a very robust mandate to neutralize the armed groups. So it happened. Now the challenge for 2014 is to continue making that happen with other groups. We are dealing with various rebels in the north of North Kivu, further south. They're called ADF, they're called FDLR. This is a very complex thing. We have to work with the Congolese army. We have to take care of the political sensitivities in the region. But I do hope that one of our basic concepts on the ground, which is the minute we liberate a part of the territory, even a small one, we make it an island of stability. We make it so that the Congolese state comes back with its police, with its army, with its préfet or sous-préfet. And we try to consolidate all these islands of stability to connect them one with the other and enlarge the patches of regions that have been freed from those terrible people, who are being freed from the trafficking that's taking place. And that's the thrust of what we're doing. So very cautiously, but I would say we have embarked last year on a positive trend, and I hope we can continue that.
Thank you. That's a very encouraging story. Actually, one small follow-up, and then we'll go to the audience. On Congo, do you start to see progress in the Congolese armed forces themselves? Because clearly people talk about the need for someday transitioning to the state itself, being able to control its own territory. I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Congo 30 years ago. We obviously didn't do great in giving it a lot of capacity. You've done amazing work even to get things to where they are at this point. But, of course, one wants to think at least notionally about a long-term exit strategy. Do you see the beginnings of hope that the Congolese army can begin to hold some of this progress that you've been able to make?
It is an act of faith, given the record of the past, I would say. But I think, again, last year has been a cause for encouragement. They have behaved much more professionally, more robustly. And indeed, collaboration with MONUSCO has been better. Now, this has its limits. In particular, we know that they're not very strong on human rights. They're not very strong on respect for women or for children. And they're not very strong on not giving themselves sometimes to trafficking. So it's a matter of being very cautious, you know, not extending credit without appropriate monitoring. We do have policies, you know, the human rights due diligence policy. We have vetting processes, and we apply that relentlessly. And when there are shortcomings, to say the least, when there are violations, then we have to be without pity. It's not easy. After the rapes in Minova in November 2012, I personally and all my colleagues, we pushed on the government of Kinshasa to make it happen that there be a real court case, not what you could call a monkey.
Kangaroo. Huh?
Yeah. The result was a sort of mixed, I have to say, unfortunately. And that is not acceptable to me because the perpetrators would really have to be sanctioned and really sanctioned. But, okay, let's try and make it that it doesn't happen any further yet.
Very good. By the way, I should have mentioned that the Twitter handle is UN Peacekeeping for anybody looking to follow there. Let me take a couple of, you want to take a couple of questions at a time, or do you want to just do them individually?
Sure.
So we'll do two at a time. And when we start in the very back, just to your left, yes, and then right behind the gentleman after.
Okay. Hi, my name is Kenneth Rothschild. The question is, to what degree do the larger state players, those in the Security Council and so forth, get in your way? I mean, many of the problems have been created to extract resources from different parts of the world. A lot of the boundaries have been drawn. And there seems to be a resistance for large places to want to give up their sovereignty in the world, and therefore it's very hard to really operate. Would you speak some about that, please?
Thanks. And we can take one more just behind you, if that's okay. There was a hand.
Thank you. Ken Meyercord, World Docs. Why does the UN refuse to take responsibility for the cholera introduced into Haiti by UN peacekeepers?
Do you want to take those two, and then we'll do another
yes,
one?
Yes, gladly. On the first question, I think you would first notice that most Security Council resolutions, especially on the African issues, have been voted unanimously. And that, I think, is a fact of contemporary politics. You know, you don't have agendas, you know, which collide frontally as they would have had possibly at the time of the Cold War. I think there is genuine and shared concern for the plight of all these African countries. Needless to say, there are, of course, specific concerns, and sometimes for the better. I mean, forget I'm French, but I think if France had not shown the lead on Mali in January 2013, I'm not sure what would have happened. And the same can be said about the common engagement of the United States and France on Central Africa. I think there was leadership shown, and I think nobody found any reason to disagree with this. So I think it's a positive trend. Of course, then you can have this percentage or this element of national interest that creeps in, that can take the form of an amendment in a resolution. That happens. That's a fact of life. But it's nothing that compromises the overall threat. Now, about the cholera, sir, in Haiti. First, let me say that the cholera is in itself something terrible, and I know the amount of suffering that it caused in the country. I would not go into the legal aspects of that because this is being looked at by courts, and as you know, while this is the case, we do not discuss the substance. But what I would say, and I was in Haiti just a week ago, is that a tremendous effort has been launched with the engagement of the Secretariat, of the Secretary General, to address one of the real root elements, which is the issue of water and sanitation, you know, that really has made the Haitians so vulnerable. So there is what is called the Hispaniola Initiative to eradicate cholera from both Santo Domingo and Haiti, and support that with, I think, more than $2 billion worth of projects over the next several years to really take care of it and make it so that people do not suffer further. And I must say the medical data, helped in part by a vaccination campaign that we have supported, involving the most fragile groups of the population, is showing results.
Okay, let's take two more. Why don't we... By the way, there was, in the very last row, a woman sitting down behind Mr. Rothschild, I think was looking to get in earlier. I guess I'm wrong. Okay, she's... So okay, it's over here. We'll start with my friend on the left in the white shirt, and then just in front of her.
Hi, I'm Allison Giffen with the Stimson Center's Future Peace Operations Program. You mentioned a lot about troops and military enablers, but I'm wondering if you can speak a little bit to what reforms are happening to try and increase the capabilities of the civilian personnel that are so important for the extension of state authority and protection of civilians. It's obviously an issue of roster and trying to get the right people, but there always problems with the UN's actual ability to hire and process and deploy. So if you could speak a little bit to that.
And then we'll take one more here, just two rows in front.
Hello, I'm Miriam Young with the U.S. Council on Sri Lanka. And my question has to do, you mentioned one of your priorities being the performance of the UN peacekeeping troops themselves, and the fact that there is a zero tolerance policy on sexual violence. I know that peacekeeping was on the panel of the Global Summit last week in London mm-hmm. on ending sexual violence in conflict. So my question is particularly related to the Sri Lankan forces that are serving as UN peacekeepers. I think there are some thousand of them. But there are documented reports of widespread rape and torture by the Sri Lankan security forces. One of these reports came out just a month ago. And one of the recommendations here says, call upon the UN Department of Peacekeeping Operations to immediately suspend Sri Lankan police and military involvement in UN peacekeeping missions pending an independent international inquiry. And it says, it notes it's not sufficient to screen individual officers when there is a large body of credible evidence of a pattern of widespread systematic sexual abuse of detainees by members of the security forces and collusion amongst multiple branches of the forces at high levels within the government of Sri Lanka. So my question is, what would you do in relation to this particular recommendation? And also to note that it's very troubling that you actually have a Sri Lankan general on the Peacekeeping Special Advisory Council who has been accused of war crimes that are being investigated right now by the UN Human Rights Commission. Thank you.
On the question of civilian capacities, it is indeed a reality that we have now about 14 or 15,000 civilian employees in our missions. And that has become very sizable and very necessary over the years. And it was a major effort, you know. We had this initiative inside the Secretariat called precisely Civilian Capacity, CIVCAP, which was devised to identify all the gaps, all the needs that we experience in various sectors, ranging from anything, human rights to rule of law, but the whole gamut. And indeed, we have worked a lot to establish rosters. I have to say, you know, that until I joined the United Nations in 2011, I thought the French administration was a very frail old lady that you couldn't push very much. But I have discovered that the UN administration is yet another older lady, and you can even less push forward. So that's a reality. That's also a consequence of layers upon layers of policies piled upon up by member states, but really trying to accelerate. And this is illustrated right now by what we're experiencing in Central African Republic. We transitioned from a political mission, which was Binuka, which was about 50 people, to the beginnings of a peacekeeping operation. We are allowed by the parliamentary organs to deploy 474 civilian employees before the 31st of December. And we're going to make it happen. Even we have to force it through, you know. But I think it is a necessity. Now, on the issue of performance and tolerance or non-tolerance, the policies, madam, stand. And that is very clear. But at the same time, it is true that we had specifically some Sri Lankan peacekeepers in some of our missions for quite a while. And it is true that we face some needs. Now, what do you do when you are faced with the immediate need for a field hospital in South Sudan, given the amount of suffering that the people are experiencing there? And that one country, specifically Sri Lanka, comes to you and say, Banco, I'm ready to supply you with a field hospital. I think the issue of medical personnel, I would hope, does not arise. These people have sworn the oath of Hippocrates, you say in English? And I suppose, I think we have to accept that they are true to their words. So you just make it happen. But it doesn't say that we do not do very specific vetting, you know, on officers. That we do, and we work very closely with the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights. And I can tell you that we discussed this several times and we are in agreement.
Take two more. So we'll go to the gentleman in the green shirt here, and then we'll over to the third row.
Hi, Doug Brooks, consultant these days. In the past, the UN has worked fairly closely with contractors, including using helicopters in Sierra Leone. And when they took over the mission in Darfur, the AU had some 20 contracted helicopters working for them, and then the UN decided they couldn't use contracted helicopters for some reason. In other places, specialized personnel and experts have been available from the private sector, but the UN has chosen to wait until they're offered by contributing countries. Can't there be a healthy compromise here where the contractors could be used to a greater extent and fill a lot of the gaps, from everything from just static security up to medical bases, as you just described?
I'll take one more here on the end.
Hi, my name is Reem Salahi. I had a question following up on Syria. You had mentioned that 2 years ago you had the UN had attempted to send a peacekeeping mission, and that did not work so well. Is there any updates? Is there any work being done to send more peacekeeping missions or any sort of peacekeeping thoughts on Syria, particularly given how devastating the conflict is?
Thank you. Let me take that question first. I think the sad answer, madam, is that no. Whereas a year ago we had been hinted, you know, that while some political process still retain some hope, you know, we might be called upon to stage a peacekeeping operation or something. So we did some contingency planning throughout the end of 2012 and part of 2013. But I'm very sorry to say that, unfortunately, nothing is coming out. You know, there is no sign that things are winding down. There is no sign that the killings, the suffering, the humanitarian disaster is waning down, and there is no possibility, even conceptually, to imagine that there could be a peacekeeping operation in such an environment as Syria with all the fighting that goes on. I did say that we sometimes operate in environments where there is no peace to keep, but on the scale of what has been happening in Syria, I think all we can do is continue doing the relatively small-scale operation we have on the Golan Heights between Syria and Israel. We have 1,250 people there. And, by the way, operating under very difficult circumstances because there's a lot of fighting going on in the vicinity. But on the large-scale Syria-wide operation, I think we simply have to hope that better times will come and that will be more conducive to a possible involvement. But that would be, of course, for the Security Council to consider ultimately. About contractors, I think we are being pragmatic. We do contract for helicopters with some, or we deal with member states, you know. It's a matter simply of the procurement process, you know. Sometimes it's faster to go for a letter of assistance from a member state, you know, that can provide us with either the equipment or the people. One thing, though, you did mention static security, and there we have a policy that we do not go, except when it's really incontrovertible, to private contractors. You know, we either do our own or we ask a member state to contribute a guard unit. This is what we are deploying right now in Somalia.
Thank you. Okay, I should give this side of the room a chance, so why don't we take the gentleman in the tie right there, and then come up here to the second row after that.
Hello, Brett Schaefer with the Heritage Foundation. I'm curious if you would have a response to the UN Office of Internal Oversight Services report from March.
So
the OIOS report from March,
yeah.
Which took a look at the 8 of the 9 UN peacekeeping operations with a mandate to protect civilians. And that report concluded that the UN peacekeepers responded to incidents involving civilians only 20% of the time, and only or almost never used force in responding to those incidents.
And that up here in the second row, please.
Hi, my name is Maria, and my question concerns security sector reform. So I wanted to know, like, even if we increase the number of civilian police and better equipment, better capabilities, how do we make sure that we develop a relationship of real trust and respect for the civilian population in terms of the civilian police being fully aware that their main role is to protect civilians and their properties? Also, how to make sure that they understand the local population they're working with, their culture, their needs, and what they mean by security. And also in terms of young people that may have never experienced this system before, how do we make sure that they know what to expect from the civilian police? Thank you.
On the report by the Office of Oversight, let me tell you that, of course, Darfur has always been a very difficult theater of operations. One of those precisely where no real peace has really ever existed. So it's a very violent environment. It comes in cycles. Just since the beginning of this year, we had 400,000 more displaced persons and a spate of attacks in the first few months, which was quite shocking. So it's been a difficult environment, one in which there have been clearly shortcomings. And I think we have experienced that over the last several years. I remember when 2 years ago a company attacked, under attack, simply put down their weapons, surrendered, and by the way, the officer was shot in the bomb and died for that terrible. And that was unacceptable. And we did investigate every time there was such an occurrence because it is not acceptable. Again, we investigated last year when there was a convoy escorted by blue helmets that was attacked and the people they were escorting were absconded. Unacceptable. So it's not an issue, you know, that comes up out of the blue. This is why I mentioned earlier, the first mission I gave to the Inspector General was precisely to go to Darfur and address all these issues of a systemic or organizational or technical nature, and we are implementing those now. And that, I think, remains our goal. Now, of course, OIOS says very limited cases of use of violence. But that does not recognize the fact that protection of civilians is actually a process, a political process, in which the use of force is really the in extremis solution. You use force when there is no other solution, but when you have exhausted all the other tools that you have at your disposition. Good officers, mediation, negotiations. Okay, but, you know, use of force is not the goal, is not the preferred tool of protection of civilians. And that, I think IOS, OIOS colleagues did not really recognize. So that is the reality. And let's face it, this is what we are doing every day in Darfur. Every day we have hundreds, thousands of people who go about their businesses being escorted without incident, without problems. So this has to be reflected, I think. I'm sorry.
No trouble.
On the issue of SSR and the need to reflect the desires and the expectations of the population, yes, this is something absolutely crucial. We do it for our own police. You know, we are deploying in several theaters, actually, women units
that are devised, tailored precisely to take care of the specific concerns of women in Liberia, in the Congo, in Haiti. It's happening in a very common way. We don't have specialized unit for young people yet, but that may come to be. But I think it is very important that as the state builds up again and retakes credibility, I apologize, one element of that credibility is the perception by the people that, yes, their concerns are taken care of, that there is a bond of confidence, of trust, again, after sometimes years or decades of neglect, of breach of faith, of predation by police authorities. All that has to be addressed.
Okay, we'll do one more round of questions here as we wrap up for the day. Great, thanks. You're amazing. You covered so much ground, and we're making you work despite your rough condition with your throat, so thank you. Okay, so why don't we why don't we come up here in the front row, and then the gentleman here in the black shirt, we'll wrap up there.
Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity. Nimad Ahmadi is there for Women Action Group. I really appreciate your comprehensive presentation, and you spoke to so many points that we would think of talking about it in this kind of panel. My question is specifically to Darfur. We totally understand the challenges that may face a peacekeeping mission in any way in the world and in places like Darfur, but there are clearly shortcomings that are relevant, is not to the performance of the mission and also to its leadership. There are allegations of complicity or lack of transparency or lack of reporting within the mission in Darfur. There are cases that of clear lack of action or failure of leadership to put the troop in position to protect themselves or to address the problem and the issue of reporting sexual and gender-based violence that is going on a daily basis. So whenever we raise a question, they say there is no peace to keep. We do understand that there is no peace to keep, but is it an ideal situation for the UN to have a de facto or a failed mission? Or also, is there any accountability measures for individual leaders within the mission? Do the UN monitor and hold this individual accountable, or just let them do it on their own? But the situation in Darfur is one of the most example of the failure of the individual leaders within the mission, and also the mission has no mechanism to protect not only the civilian, but it is on troops. Thank you.
And then here, right behind. Thank you.
Ben Gross, GlobalSolutions.org. My quick question is, we've seen the recent kind of violence and kind of escalation in Iraq, and we were wondering, would there be any kind of potential for a peacekeeping mission in Iraq? And if so, what kind of, how successful do you think it could possibly be?
On Darfur, I think I have explained earlier, madam, that we, and certainly I, have taken these issues very seriously. Every single failure has been investigated, and I quoted two incidents. I don't think it is fair, if I may say so, to say that it is a failed mission. It is a mission that has been fraught with problems, but fraught first and foremost with a terrible situation. And let's face it, in a context where cooperation of the government of the Sudan has not been exemplary, to say the least. This is why we launched this strategic review early this year, and we give ourselves till the end of the year to see what are the improvements in the military performance, improvements in the cooperation by the government of Khartoum, and improvement in the general working of the UN family in the country. And if this is not satisfactory, convincing, then we shall, the Security Council shall consider how to best handle this situation. This being said, I would add that perhaps in a way as a result of this mission by the Inspector General in the early part of this year, we have seen a change in the pattern of in which things happen on the ground. recent weeks, we have had attacks which were reacted to in a robust way by the troops, in part because we have changed some of the troops, you know, the less combative, the less well-equipped. We told them to pack and go home, and thank you, and bring in new people who are better equipped, better trained, more combative, makes a difference. Only last week, there was a group of attackers who fell onto one of our columns. We had one guy killed, they had six. Do you know that the following day, the attackers were coming to UNAMID to apologize, actually also asking for blood money, which is something different. But they did apologize, and that's something that we hadn't seen for quite a while. So we are waiting until we have better patterns, you know, of what is happening on the ground. And if the trends do confirm, then we will communicate, because I think there is something happening there. About Iraq, I'm sorry that I cannot really comment, you know. It is something that would be for the Security Council to decide upon. What I can tell you is that given the gravity, the complexity, and the scale of what it is that has been happening in recent weeks in Iraq, and let's not forget also with some of the neighbors, it is something that would be far beyond the scope for the United Nations to be able to handle. So this, I think, is where we stand. But of course, with great sadness at all the suffering that is taking place yet there also, and the severity of the stakes, what is at stake there. And there I speak more as a citizen, as a person, but it is a great, great, great concern.
Sir, thank you very much for all you taught us today, all your time, and we appreciate very much your being here at Brookings.